Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where honest-to-goodness network engineers gather in the virtual conference room. We chat about news, work life, and the next big thing coming to your data center. Today, we're getting a quick update on Cisco Live, and we're going to hear from a couple of brand new CCIEs who just passed their routing and switching labs. So first off, we have Tom Hollingsworth with us. And Tom, tell us about the weather in Las Vegas.
It is hot. It's about 105 degrees outside, but luckily I've been ducking back and forth between air conditioners the entire time. So it's been tolerable.
What's the, you're at the show, you're at Cisco Live, and you know, we heard that on the last little podcast that went out. What's the coolest thing you've seen at the show that you had never seen before? Anything stand out?
They're doing a lot with collaboration right now, and so they've got a lot of really cool collaboration demos. They actually have an entire on-site lab here, so I got to go in and play with a whole bunch of stuff yesterday that I've never really got to see, like the Cisco CIS or some of the Tanberg endpoints or things like that. And when I get done here, I'm going to go down and tear the data center guys apart and see all their cool new stuff too.
Nice. Now, speaking of CIS, I heard a rumor that you might have won a CIS.
Yeah, actually, I just did. Thanks to Cisco Collaboration, I am now the proud owner of a CIS. And so after I figure out how to get it set up and play with it a little bit, I will probably try to do a little bit on a podcast about it just so people can kind of understand that what's going on with it and the fact that it really does exist.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking the setup process was something like you kind of hold it in your hand sort of frisbee-like, and you pull your arm back, you throw forward rapidly, get it spinning, and then it hits the water, and it kind of skips real nice and settles. And when it lands at the bottom of the pond, all the data and configuration information kind of gets loaded into it from the cloud, and then you're good. That's kind of something like that. It was kind of a vague white paper. I don't remember exactly, but
no, the hand pops up, grabs it, configures it for you, and throws it back.
But the problem is, I'm in the middle of Las Vegas, so there are no bodies of water around.
Ah. Of course. And, of course, that voice was Mr. Greg Farrow, our grumpy old CCIE, coming to us today from London. And, Greg, what is exciting in your world?
My world today, I'm surrounded by Fibre Channel and Fibre Channel over Ethernet. I've spent the better part of 5 hours meeting with the storage team to design a new data center. And my love affair with FCOE continues unabated. The hate and passion does not get any love. Fair dinkum, if FC is a networking protocol, it is the bastard spawn of a goblin and a troll.
And also coming to us from Paris is Nicolas Michel. He's still getting used to his brand new CCIE number. And has the shock worn off for you yet, sir?
Oh, yeah, it was a shock. I received my results on Monday morning at 7 a.m. And, man, I just see you passed, and wow, I was like, what is my number? And my number is 29410, and I'm so proud of it.
Awesome. Congratulations. And then, of course, we have Kurt Bales joining us from Sydney, so we're really covering the globe today. Kurt, you're working on your CCIE, aren't you?
Yep, currently studying for my CCIE, hoping to take the lab in December.
How's the? You think you're going to be ready by that time frame?
I should be ready by that time frame. I've taken a non-standard route for studying for my CCIE by studying for my JNCIE at the same time. So I'm getting there.
Yeah, of course. And I am Ethan Banks, your host today. Today we're really going to focus on CCIE preparation. What's it really take to get through the lab? I mean, CCIE certification is still one of the toughest to get in the biz, and it's the one a lot of the networking guys, that particularly those working in the Cisco world, look to, and they say, "That's it, man. If I could be a CCIE, that's the one I want to get." You know, curtains will part, choirs of angels will sing. If I just had my CCIE number, I could do anything I want. Rich and famous, fast cars, and the whole thing would come if I just was a CCIE. All right. So if that's the dream, we're going to talk about it today. Nicholas just got his. Tom, you just got yours. Kurt's working on his. Greg and I already are CCIEs. So let's have a conversation. Now, we've got some questions that came in from Twitter. Thanks to you guys that respond. And, Tom, let me start with you. How long did you prepare for the CCIE? And let's talk about both written and lab, because there's really two components to this thing.
Really about 4 years. It took me about, I don't know, 8 months to really prep for the written and pass it. And then with all the studying, everything like that, and the multiple attempts that it took me to get through the lab, it was about 3 years of lab study. So it was not a trivial investment to make in time or money.
Nicholas, is your story kind of the same? How long did you take in your preparations?
No, my story is different. I started to study in February last year, and it took me 6 or 7 months to pass the written. And I did a mistake when I was studying for the written. I was only reading. I read Jeff Doerr's book, MPLS Fundamentals, so many book, BGP book, multicast book. And I think that my biggest mistake was that I avoided the CLI in my written exam, because you need to understand how Cisco is implementing the protocols in their routers and switches. And then I passed my written in September, and since that time I'm studying like a mad guy, and I'm labbing all the time. And I passed 2 weeks ago in June, and on my first attempt.
Yeah, you know, it's funny what you're talking about with the written. I did the same thing. I ended up with the Odom book, the Routing and Switching Certification Guide, and read it, and I ended up blogging about each chapter to make sure I kind of understood the concept. And but I didn't really spend a lot of time at the CLI. I mean, I was doing it for work and so on, but I think I made a similar kind of mistake. I did a lot of reading and a lot of just kind of trying to regurgitate the facts, but that doesn't really help solidify the concepts as much as actually sitting down and configuring something does. Yeah, so there's an encouragement for everybody to you know, throw some practice, even when you're prepping just for the written, you know, do some practice work there.
Yeah, and what's great is that when you're configuring something, for example, let's say you are learning OSPF. Well, if you are studying for the CCIE, you probably know OSPF, but you want to know what's going on when you type IP OSPF network or something like this. And with the CLI, you are able to use the debugs. And the debugs are so useful in a lab at home. And this is with the debugs that you will learn a lot.
Now, Greg, you're a CCIE from way back. Did they even have OSPF? Was it even invented back then? That's a long time.
No, but ATM and Token Ring was. But it wasn't. It was a different exam. So I was playing the grumpy old CCIE, you know, back in the two-day exam. And it was a different kind of thing. The written exam was been designed back then to be a completely different knowledge set. So it was testing a certain knowledge that wasn't in the lab exam. And so the written exam was just something that you got done and then you forgot about it because you moved into a different set of studying for the lab exam.
Yeah, I mean, the written exam today is really that. It's kind of like the price of admission. It's buying a ticket so you can go at the lab. The knowledge does build, but it's almost it's just like, just get through the stupid thing, you know, get that trivia exam done, and now let's prep for the lab, which is a whole different kind of thing. Kurt, have you gotten the written done at this point?
Yeah, I sat the written at Cisco Live Melbourne in March, so I've got that out of the way. So
are you doing routing and switching as well?
Yeah, doing routing and switching.
They have the tectorials here at Cisco Live. They had 250 people in the route switch tectorial. They had less than 20 in the wireless tectorial. And, you know, there's just there's not that much. In my mind, there's more demand for RNS overall than there is for all the other tracks combined.
Yeah, and I saw a stat in one of the PDFs I downloaded from CiscoLiveVirtual.com that said something like 16,000 odd routing and switching, and then way down below that for the rest, wireless and voice and SAN and so on. And so, yeah, it's definitely a lot less demand for the other tracks. Although the one I hear is the easiest to jump from routing and switching is service provider. But let's talk a little bit about hours of practice for the lab. I mean, that's kind of a number. I think I tried to quantify how many hours I'd actually practiced for the lab. This was back in 2007, 2008. And it was something in the order of, I couldn't nail it down for sure, but between 500 and 1,000 hours of either doing practice labs, sitting at the CLI and trying different things, but actually working towards being able to get the lab, do 8 hours worth of labbing in less than 8 hours, if you know what I'm saying. You know, that time management and actually, you know, getting through it. Tom, how many did you, you did multiple attempts and all that. You get any idea how many hours you got tied up in labbing?
I lost track. I would come home from work, and I would eat dinner and put my kids to bed, and then immediately go into my bedroom and fire up a router or a virtual lab until my wife came and tapped me on the shoulder and went, honey, it's 2 a.m. You really need to come to bed. So I lost track, and it seemed like every waking minute there was this little voice in the back of my head that said, you should be labbing. You should be studying. You should be doing something.
Yeah.
And it's just you lose track of it because it just becomes your life after a while.
Yeah, plus it's your day job, but you've got a day job, plus you've got a family, like you were saying, and so you're trying to make room to squeeze in lab hours around that. Nicholas, what about you? You did the whole thing at a little bit shorter of a window. How many hours did you have tied up in lab practice?
Oh, lots. I lost track, too. I was maybe doing 5 or 6 hours a day, and during the weekend I was able to work for like 20 hours during the weekend.
Now, how did you do your practice? Were you doing a? Did you have your own rack? Did you have like emulator, like GNS 3? Were you renting a rack?
Oh, okay. Sorry, I was lucky to have a friend who has a personal rack, and since he was living in Los Angeles, when he was sleeping, I was able to work on his rack.
Yeah. Yeah, I was lucky in that I took some older equipment that had gotten retired from a data center move, and I was able to put a rack together and do my practice in that way. Kurt, are you practicing for lab stuff right now, and how are you going about that?
I am currently practicing. I've got I'm lucky at work. We've got a lot of spare equipment and test equipment and demo equipment, so I was able to hack up parts of the lab I needed on demand, as well as GNS while I'm moving around. So just working through some workbooks and some practice labs and so forth. So
here's another question for anybody who wants to take a stab at it. What about the emulation stuff? Have any of you spent any time with any of the emulators that allow you to load an iOS image in a binary and crank up a bunch of routers in an emulated format?
Well, I use an emulator, but only when I wanted to try some small stuff. You know, I was doing one command, and I just wanted to see how to implement this in a little IP subnet, and that's it.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky enough to have actual equipment to get on as well, and didn't really go down the road of emulation because I didn't need to. But my understanding is, if you got enough CPU horsepower, it's pretty easy to get. I wouldn't say pretty easy, but generally speaking, you can get a full scale lab going in an emulated environment, and have it work. But certain processes can really peak out your CPU sometimes. Is there a switch available in an emulator now that someone knows about? That used to be one of the hang-ups, is you couldn't really do switching.
Not officially.
I've heard stories that there is a layer 2 IOU image that allows you to run iOS on Unix, and we can actually run that in a Linux platform, which means it's well-named by Cisco as usual. And it actually does many of the switching things that you need to get. And I also know that IP Expert is publishing an IOU lab guide, so they are actually mapping their configuration into an IOU. As I understand it, last time I spoke to Marco Miller from IP Expert, I'm not going to say his last name because I get
Mili Bozovic.
Oh, that's pretty close. They actually publish a lab guide which you can use in IOU to map their lab configuration into, which is pretty close. Now, I believe Marco said you'll still need to do some hands-on time on actual gear, but you can use IOU in the same way that many people have used Dynamips to achieve 80% of their configuration time for labbing.
I mean, you can do a quick Google search and figure out Dynamips and GNS3 if you're looking for that GUI layer on top of it to help you with the setups and so on. Is IOU pretty publicly available at this point, or is that still a secret?
It's still a secret, but I'm sure if you did some diligent searching, you can find what you're looking for.
Aha. Enough said. All right, so here's another question that came in, and that is regarding boot camps, CCIE boot camps, the idea of you're going to disconnect from the rest of your world, you're going to go to some training facility, and for, you know, a week or more, you're going to do nothing but prepare for the CCIE lab. There, you're going to get lectures from presumably a very good instructor. You're going to do hands-on practice with a workbook, and you are going to do the reading, the studying, the practice, interact with other CCIE lab candidates, and study, and hopefully walk away looking better with brighter prospects for passing your lab. Did any of you guys do boot camps?
I did. I went to Micronics boot camp from Narbit Kocharyan's back in 2008.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that I went to Narbit's boot camp is because he has a policy that you can always go back and retake his boot camp. Just if you can provide your own rack, you can sit in there and listen to his lectures.
I can corroborate that. I went to Narbit's boot camp twice, and the second time was exactly that. I hadn't taken the lab yet, but I wanted to run through it another time and provided my own rack. And I actually took a week of vacation and paid my way to do it because it didn't cost me anything other than the travel. And yeah, he's a good instructor. I hope you're about to say nice things about him.
He's the best instructor I've ever met. Yeah, he's great. He's so great. I blogged about the review of his bootcamp, and man, I don't know how he's doing it. He's standing in front of the whiteboard and speaking 8 hours of a speech, and it was amazing. Yeah, it was the greatest bootcamp I've ever done. And I also did an INE bootcamp, which was great. I met some very good people. But
INE is an internet work expert, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And Narbit, but he's unbelievable. Unbelievable. Save money and go to Narbit, and you will have a very, very instructive iOS lesson.
Tom, were you pretty much okay with Narbit as well, or?
Oh, yes. Actually, Narbit is here at Cisco Live, and when I get off this podcast, I'm going to go find him and shake his hand and thank him for everything that he did for me for passing the lab. He's an amazing resource, and he's so personable. I mean, yeah. I could just sit there and listen to him tell stories all day long, and he has so many great ones.
Yeah.
So that's not.
Yeah.
But getting to know the other instructors, like Marco is very personable as well. I mean, I've been talking to Marco all week, and I think that if I was going to go for another track, I would probably go to IP Expert now because, you know, I like the way that Marco thinks about these things, and, you know, like especially for those ones like voice or, you know, wireless, where there's not a whole lot of material out there from Narbit on that, because he tends to work more on the core, like route switch and service provider, where he's comfortable. And so, you know, you have to analyze the program track that you're on and understand who the better people are at that, because there are the vendors, the bootcamp vendors are better in places. Some are good at one thing and some are good at another. And it's not a knock on them for saying, oh, well, you guys don't do voice, so you must not be any good. They're just really good at the things they do.
Now, I'm going to make a statement about boot camps, and then you guys can tell me if you agree or disagree and why. I think of a boot camp as finishing school. You don't go when you're early in your lab prep. You go when you're later in your lab prep, and you're pretty – maybe you even have your lab date on the calendar, or you're pretty serious about getting one on there. You need to brush up on certain technologies. You need to kind of knock off the rough edges, but you're pretty close. Would you agree with that for boot camp or not?
Yeah, I tend to agree, because I did my first boot camp at the beginning of my preparation, and the lecture were great. I learned a lot, but the Merck labs, I was just like, what the heck? I scored only 30 points, 30, 35, 40, and I was disappointed. On my second boot camp, I was like, oh, I know this stuff, and I was very confident. And yes, I agree with you.
Yeah. Tom, anything to add to that?
No, we actually, my first boot camp, they had someone in there who had just basically passed his CCNA, and Narbik told him up front, he said, you're going to miss a lot of the material in this class because it's not going to make any sense to you. But by the end of it, you'll know what you need to know when you come back in 6 months after you've spent that time studying. There is no point in you spending money on a boot camp when you first start studying. You need a gauge for where you're at, because the first thing a boot camp instructor will ask you if they're good is, what are your weak areas? And if you have more than two weak areas, you don't need to be in a boot camp. You need to be back home studying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when you're sitting in a boot camp and listening to lectures and working on labs and you're doing it for 16, 18 hours a day, that's assuming you wuss out and actually sleep, then it's like drinking from the fire hose. You're just not going to get it all. There's a lot that's just going to get blown right by you. So yeah, it sounds like we've all had a similar experience then. I mean, Kurt, have you done any boot camp stuff yet, or are you considering any?
Well, one of the joys of living in the far-flung corners of the universe, or Australia, is that the boot camps rarely come here. There are a couple of local boot camps, and I know Narbik's actually doing one, but I'm looking at doing my lab on the Friday, and his boot camp is on the following Monday. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so in case you guys that are listening don't know who Narbik is, we're talking about Narbik Kacharyan, who I believe is the Triple CCIE, he's a Cisco Press author, and that's Micronics. That's the Micronics boot camp that we're talking about. And also we've mentioned InternetWorkExpert.com. You can find from their site about their boot camps, and also IPExpert.com. I believe I've got those URLs correct. You can check out all their stuff. For anyone listening who's not familiar with these names that we're tossing around like we know these people, because we kind of know these people. Let's talk about the lab experience itself for a minute. Nicholas, do you think the lab was easier or more difficult than you expected?
Well, it will be different for everybody. It really depends on the preparation. If you are not preparing that much, well, the lab is going to be your worst nightmare you did in your life. But if you prepared very well, I can say that it would be easy. It was easy for me. I managed to finish the lab with 2 hours left. It was easy. Only the troubleshooting section was pretty challenging.
So the way the lab is broken out now, and this is different from when I took it, and I know it's different from when Greg took it as well, there is two sections. You've got a configuration section and you've got a troubleshooting section. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. You have 10 tickets, if I remember. The 10 tickets, you have to solve them within 2 hours, and then you can continue with the configuration, and you have 6 hours.
So you start out with troubleshooting tickets, or you end up with troubleshooting tickets?
Oh, you start with troubleshooting tickets.
Oh, wow.
And it's mandatory to have 80% to pass.
Now, Greg, just going back in time a little bit, when you did this, it was a two-day lab, like you said, and you had to actually build everything, configure the rack, plug everything in and the whole thing. Is that right?
Yeah, to some extent. There was certain equipment that was configured in the day, but what Nicholas just said there about you have to have 80%, that also applied. So in the original two-day exam, you had morning of the first day, and if you didn't have 80% of the marks for the morning, you're sent home. Mm-hmm. And then again, they looked at your lab at the end of the first day, and you would either find out at the end of the first day or in the morning when you arrived back the next day, it varied. If you didn't have 80% of the marks, you were never going to pass, so you were sent home.
Yeah.
So it was a fairly... So when you first got in, you had to configure the console server, then you had to plug in your frame relay switch and patch it all up, and if the cables didn't work, you had to troubleshoot it, and yes, all that sort of stuff.
And my understanding, Greg, back in the day, is that they'd break it for you at some point as well, and you were expected to find what they broke for you.
The second half of the second day was called troubleshooting, and you'd leave the room for lunch, and when you came back, your network had either been broken, so the instructor had done something to it, several things to it, and then you had to, or you were told to load a predetermined set of configs. It depended on what sort of lab scenario you were on, and then you had to find everything that was wrong, and you had to write down everything that you found was wrong and why it was wrong and what you did to fix it.
Yeah.
And that was
20 marks or something.
Now, Tom, you took the lab multiple times. So here's a question about time that someone asked. Do you feel pressured for time during the lab? And maybe compare some of your, I don't know how many times it took you before you passed, but compare some of the earlier experiences to this last time when you passed.
So the first time I took the lab was no open-ended questions, no troubleshooting section. It was just straight labbing. And in that one, I didn't feel pressured for time. My problem was content. Now, as it got progressively more and more where they started piling more things in there, like troubleshooting, there was more of a time constraint. This last lab attempt, which is similar to the one that Nicholas took, the troubleshooting section is artificially pressured because you have such a short time to fix so many things. The actual lab itself, there was no time constraints because I didn't waste any time. I actually finished 2.5 hours early and spent 1.5 hours troubleshooting everything in my lab.
Nice.
Yeah, that was kind of my experience when I took it. I did not have a troubleshooting section on mine. This is 2008. I did not feel pressured for time. I finished with, I'd have to go back and look at my write-up that I did back in the day from when I did, but I had something like 1 hour left, and I went back through and was able to check configurations and make sure that I was meeting all of the requirements that the proctor had asked, and actually had found an error or two and fixed them along the way. And I think, you know, to sum up the question, were you pressured for time during the lab, comes down to how many configs do you know off the top of your head versus how much stuff are you poking around in the documentation trying to look up. The more you know off the top of your head, the easier and faster this is going to go for you in the lab versus, oh, they want me to do, I don't know, just throw something out, iOS firewall. I don't remember how to do that. I got to go look up, you know, how to do whatever it is, and then you got to dig around and find it, and oh, yes, I remember now, and then you killed 10 minutes doing that. Well, in a time-limited scenario, man, time goes by quick, and the more times you got to look something up, the faster that time's going to go by. So there were things that I recall I just memorized, you know, frame relay, anything related to frame relay, just you knew you were going to have frame relay. You knew there were one of maybe 3 or 4 different topologies you were likely to see, and you knew you were probably going to have to configure OSPF on top of it, or that was a safe bet. So that was one of the things that when I was practicing, I just went through and I memorized how to do that when I needed non-broadcast multi-access or point-to-point or what all my types were and how to manipulate certain things. Didn't have to look up, didn't have to think about it, just did it, and I knew it cold and I knew how to check it. And that stuff that you memorize is the thing that's going to save you a whole lot of time. Would you guys say that the troubleshooting section was more difficult than the configuration section? It kind of sounds like you're saying yes, but...
Yes. The sixth lab attempt that I took in March, the reason I failed was because of the troubleshooting section. I had underestimated it, and it kicked me in the tail. And
did you say the sixth one?
Yes, I actually took the lab 7 times.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment.
Man.
So technically, I passed the config section on attempt number 6. So I've passed about 2 CCI labs, but the troubleshooting section killed me,
yeah.
And I was so mad because I didn't answer enough tickets, and I ran out of time because I got bogged down on one and I refused to let it go, and this time I specifically told myself when I got in there, I'm like, if you can't solve this ticket in 10 minutes, move on to the next one. Don't get caught up with something. And that's what they're trying to test it on, is people who have that situational awareness and can get around those things.
Well, it sounds like you're the right person to ask this next question then, which is, how did you avoid getting frustration? Stuff like, I can't do this, or I forgot this again, or I've done this 100 times, and all of a sudden it's not working now. How do you cope with frustration, both on the practice side when you're getting ready for the lab, and then in the lab itself?
Copious amounts of alcohol helps. Now, and I can freely say this now, but after attempt number 6, I was seriously beginning to get discouraged. I was telling myself, maybe you're just not cut out to be CCIE. Maybe you're just going to be a CCMP for the rest of your life. But you have to persevere, and so you have to find things that you did good. Like, okay, so this time you did a really good job of multicast, so we know that that's a good area for you, so maybe you need to spend more time picking up the little pieces. Like, you know, why did you get a 70 on layer 2? You need to go back and you need to get those layer 2 pieces a little better. You need to work on speed. You need to work on not going to the documentation CD to verify everything. I mean, I went to the doc CD twice on my pass, And one of those was to verify a command that I'd already put in and knew was working. I just wanted to be sure of the syntax on it. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, you have to find those little victories. And the way I always describe it to people now is it's like climbing Mount Everest. You know, when you're right there at base camp and you're ready to make the summit, you can't stop and start thinking about all the reasons why you shouldn't climb Everest. You have to find all the reasons why you should and keep going for those.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I think it's also important to recognize that different people have different ways. So, for example, in the days when I was studying, for every hour of lab time I spent labbing something, and I think I spent about 400 hours lab time, I would try and spend an hour in the textbooks, so reading up. So I would go and do something in OSPF and then spend time reinforcing that with coming back to the theoretical knowledge. And the theoretical knowledge, and this is where you say don't look in the documentation, is understanding how a protocol works. So when we say RIP has split horizon, understand why it has split horizon, and then understand what the impacts are, and then try and comprehend why Cisco wants you to learn RIP in the modern day era. And the answer is because they want you to understand split horizon, because split horizon is used for many things. For example, in a VMware vSwitch, they do split horizon forwarding. So those technologies keep repeating. So, for example, a lot of people complain that frame relay is still used in the lab, but frame relay is extremely relevant today, because frame relay is a precursor to asynchronous transfer mode, an ATM. And before frame relay, there was a thing called SMDS, and these were all non-broadcast multiple access technologies. Even today, in certain MPLS networks, there are non-broadcast multiple access designs of MPLS where certain carriers just don't allow broadcasts across their MPLS networks. All these things that you learn are still in use today, and more importantly, will come back tomorrow. So today, everything is Ethernet. Today, everything's IP, but tomorrow it'll be IPv6. When I was at the end of 1999, when I first kicked off my CCIE studies, I had to learn DECnet, AppleTalk, IPX, and IPv4. And even earlier than that, for the written exam, I had to do Apollo X and S and Banyan Vines. Now, those protocols have all gone and passed by, but that IPX knowledge is now actually being used by me in IPv6, because there's actually parts of the IPX protocol that got carried forward in the protocol design of IPv6. So don't get phased and sit there and say, why am I studying this? It's hopeless. There is a meaning. The people who write the exams deliberately select technologies that are meaningful for the future. And they're not looking at it on a 1 year or 2 year. They're looking at a 2 year, 10 year career lifespan to take those lessons of technology and apply them to you today.
And I think one of the biggest places that all that shows up is in all the changing data center technologies that we have now, where the reason certain technologies are coming out and there's new fabric designs and we're trying to do away with spanning tree, it helps to kind of understand where things were to know where we're going and why. I feel bad for some of the young guys just getting started in network engineering in a certain sense, because there's all this foundational knowledge that I'm drawing upon that Greg was just talking about. I don't go back quite as far as Greg, but even so, I had my AppleTalk IPX IPv4 network that I managed at one point in time, and all of those things add up and help. And I still remember troubleshooting problems with, well, how come this network segment is slow? Because someone on their Apple Mac left the chooser open and it's broadcasting. Okay, well, you take a basic bit of knowledge like that, and that is still relevant today, even though AppleTalk's long gone. You know, dealing with and managing broadcast, keeping domains small is all relevant. This kind of leads into a different a topic here relating to lab preparation, which is mentoring. We talked about boot camps, but is there anybody, you know, a grumpy old guy like Greg or someone that you guys worked with that you look to as a mentor? Nicholas, Tom, or Kurt, any of you guys run into someone like that that you're bouncing your CCIE lab prep questions off of?
No, when I was a CCNA or CCNP, I was using the Cisco Learning Network. But then at the CCIE level, you have to choose a partner. I mean, you have to choose IP Expert or CC Bootcamp or INE or NARBIC. And then I was posting on the forums only. And no, I didn't have any mentor.
I didn't have one either. I pretty much went the whole route through Cisco on my own. And so it was, if I needed to bounce questions off of people, that's what I used Twitter for, was, you know, asking lab prep stuff. You know, Ethan, reading your old blog or some of the other blogs that were out there was really kind of where I started, you know, picking up a lot of things. So my interaction for the most part was one way. It was receiver only. It was only in the last year that I started giving back and talking through things.
Yeah, I mean, my experience is kind of the same in that, you know, part of the reason I, back in 2007, I started up with CCIECandidate.com was because I didn't really find a good resource out there. And at my place of employment where I was working, I was already one of the lead engineers. So I had other guys that I could bounce this and that off of, but no one else was going down the CCIE track. And you really get into some deep and heavy stuff, kind of plumbing the depths of the protocols, if you will, with some esoteric details and knowledge that if you can find someone that could be a mentor for you, that's great. But I ended up turning online, not finding quite enough there either, and just started blogging about stuff. Now a lot of people blog, which is great. Now there's the group study mailing list. Did you guys participate in that, anybody?
Nope.
I didn't. Yeah,
well, in my day, it was the only thing. There was really only two resources. There was some sample work labs that came from CC Bootcamp, which everybody bought. There was a study book that came from a Caslow. We just called it Caslow's Bridges, but it was a textbook of the day. And there was the group study list, and we used to sit there and just email everything off group study. And we should get Paul Borghese onto the show one day, Ethan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's still a very active list. Last I knew, it got the signal-to-noise ratio could be a little tough sometimes. Kurt, do you participate in group study at all?
Not in group study, but I am using the IP Expert online study list. Mm-hmm. So that's been helpful. Also provided a few laughs occasionally, but
yeah,
it's been pretty helpful. Just even while I'm prepping, even if it's topics I'm not working on, it's kind of like, oh, you know, put that away in the memory banks for when I get to that topic, or this is something I should watch out for.
So. Yeah. Did any of you guys use any study aids for things like, how do you remember some of the obscure lists that are helpful to remember, or things like the hello timers of all the different protocols that, you know, it varies by protocol and can vary by, you know, what sort of interface the protocol is lit up on and so on. How do you remember all that stuff?
I have mental case for my iPad and my iPhone, and I know Greg's blogged about it in the past, and his blog was the first place that I looked to see that. And you know, I may not have time in some of my business schedule to sit down and crack open a lab guide or something like that, or MPLS fundamentals. But if I code those flashcards into mental case, then I can, you know, like if I'm in a doctor's office and I've got a 5-minute wait, I can pop it up and go, okay, what does a BGP neighbor start state look like? A neighbor establishment. You know, those are the kinds mm-hmm. of things that I can keep in my head. And the way that I learn that reinforcement over and over again makes it stick.
Yeah. Nicholas, what did you do?
Yeah, I bought Wooding Beats short notes from Ruam Duplessis. He's a South African guy. He's a double CCIE in routing and switching and a service provider. And man, he did such a great job with a little book. I print that book, and this book is in my case all the time. And I'm reading it all the time, and I'm labbing it when I'm not sure about the implementation of the CLI. And it's great, 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 and also it's very cheap.
Yeah, I ended up using some little freeware tool called, I think it was TreeView, but it allowed you to, in a tabular format, put in
mind
notes
maps.
About whatever you want. It was it was a mind map sort of a tool like that, and so I would just stream a whole bunch of information from my brain about protocols and build lists, and then I would refer to that from time to time. So I try to condense all this critical knowledge that was hard to remember about a protocol into these lists, and kind of like Tom, I just would drill them repeatedly when I could. Any of you guys using OneNote? I keep hearing people talk about how awesome OneNote is for stuff like this.
No, I don't.
I use OneNote to keep notes for what I do in my daily life. I mean, but OneNote to me is a filing cabinet,
yeah.
So it's a little harder to use as a study tool.
Yeah.
I was using OneNote when I still use Windows. Since I moved to Mac, It's probably the only Microsoft product I miss. So I don't say that very often.
Yeah. So you guys that are CCIEs now are new doors opening for you on the job market, would you say, or are you anticipating that that's going to happen? Nicholas, you were just saying earlier in the call that you've already been kind of looking around, right?
Yeah, since I passed my exam, I got maybe 200 calls a day, phone calls, and it's amazing. It's really, really, really amazing. But you know,
did you say 200?
Yeah, 200.
Ooh.
I got 200 on the first day, but it was for the whole country, and my phone was ringing. But you know, the people were looking for a network guy. It doesn't matter if it was a CCNA, a CCNP, or a CCIE. They just wanted a network guy. So I was like, send me maybe a description of the job. And they told me, I want to meet you. And I was like, I'm sorry, I can't. Then I turned off my phone. No, it was amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah, I mean, my experience has been just having the CCIE title. There's certain recruiter pings that I get because of my LinkedIn profile and so on. They need a CCIE to do X, or they need a senior network engineer who functions at a CCIE level to do, you know, whatever it is. They want you to build a data center or whatever. You know, I would say it's definitely opened up some opportunities that I wouldn't have otherwise had. I've certainly been able to meet some people that I wouldn't otherwise have met and made some connections in that way. If the root of that question, has the CCIE opened new doors for you, if you're wondering, is it really worth all the time and the trouble and the headache? I think the short answer is yes. But as we've all been talking here, there's a lot of sacrifice involved in it and so on. And so if you're having a hard time with it, if you can't make the time in your schedule, if you're struggling to master the concepts, you go, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I certainly went through that period, and I didn't get nearly as far down the road as Tom, six labs in, going, I don't think I want to do this. I don't think I would have lasted that long. Oh, man. But, I mean, even just going through it for the 16 months it took me from when I started until I actually finished and passed the lab, there was times of, this is crazy. What am I putting myself through this for? Is it really, is there a big payoff at the end? And I think the answer genuinely is, yeah, it's worth it. It's not the only way to build your networking career up, but
yeah, for me it's about choice. So since I've passed, I've been able to make choices that I would not be able to. I've been able to choose this job or that job. Sometimes I get to choose from three or four different jobs, and I get to choose the one which seems best to me at a given point in time. Or when I'm working with somebody, I get to choose, you know, when I'm inside a company, I, because of my skills are nominally better than other people's, then I get to choose which projects I get to work on, because I'm, you know, being in an IT department means you're in a technocracy. So the smartest person tends to sort of, not entirely true, the smartest and the nicest person tends to rise to the top. But, you know, the smartest person does rise to the top too. And you can get to choose the project you want to work in, or the technology you want to work on, or who you want to work with. And to me, passing the CCIE is about choosing the right job. And, you know, the right job might be one that is for a company you want to work for, or it might be one that pays the most. It just depends on how you look at it. Or it might be a job working for a reseller because you want a wide range of challenges. Or it might be a job with a vendor because you wanted to work at the source of the desk. You know, everybody's got different things that they want to achieve. And Ethan, if I can just say one more thing, I do think it's important for people to move through CCNA and CCNP and then into CCIE. I think people need to recognize that a lot of people don't make it through the CCIE because of the time and the expense it takes to get there. And I'd like to see people realize that there's value in moving through the CCNP, and then at least you've got that to fall back on, so that there's a reward for your effort. So even if you don't reach the high tide mark and run through the end of the race and pass the finish line of, you know, passing your CCIE exam, a CCNP with some good research time, some good learning time around the CCIE skill set will be far more valuable in the marketplace. You'll do better in your company, you'll do better in a team, and the CCNP will get you through those doors to talk to those people and for you to prove yourself in a job interview.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Greg, for sure. I was CCNA, CCNP, and CCSP before I ever started down the CCIE road. I had that behind me and was doing a lot of work in the industry already. I mean, I'd had several years behind me before I started thinking I should get serious and go after the CCIE now with the certs. I think you alluded to something else that I think a lot of people make this mistake of. I'm fresh out of college. I'm just going to hammer through these tests, and I'll be making, $200,000 a year and nothing flat. I just got to get my CCIE. And, it's not as simple as that. Sure, you might pass the lab, but, I mean, you do, to truly understand what you're doing and be able to be most effective as a network engineer and architect functioning at a CCIE level, you need to have the experience behind you as well. And I think all of us on this call have some years behind us, in the industry. That is certainly a helpful thing to have. There's no shortcut to glory, in other words.
Yeah, and being a CCIE, it doesn't mean that that you know everything. The people just need to know that once you're a CCIE, this is the real moment that you will realize that you need to learn, and again learn. I know some people that are not CCNA, they are not CCNP, they are not CCIE, but they can make me look dumb, you know? So being a CCIE, for me, it means that I need to improve my skills again.
Yeah, I mean, what I found going through the CCIE was incredibly humbling in that you find out all the things you don't know and just how little you really do know and how much more there is to learn, even having
absolutely.
The lab. Oh, it's ridiculous how much more there is out there. And you guys that go through
once you've mastered routing and switching, you go on to learn proxy servers like Bluecoats and ISAs, and then you go on to learn firewalls, and then you learn about VPNs.
Absolutely.
Once you've learned about VPNs, you start learning about logging servers and SIEMs, security integrated threat management system, security mitigation systems, and then they come along and say, right, now here's FiberChannel and FiberChannel over Ethernet. And now they give you a brand new hardware platform. Then you realize you have to understand the switching fabrics inside of the 6500 and the 7000 so you know where the bottlenecks are. And then you've learned that, and they say, right, now there's Cisco UCS servers, and they're all part of the network, and you have to understand. And then you've still got, and then they say, right, here's Fabric Path. So if I look back in my career, I've learned FDDI, Token Ring, ATM. I used to install ARCNET networks back in the day, and Ethernet. And out of all those, that knowledge is now useless. the exam that you passed is actually just the first day of the rest of your life. So even though you've managed to get to a certain point, you just have to keep... don't sit there and it's not like a sprint where you run over the finish line and then you lie down and you're the world champion. Life is a marathon. I think I've written about this on my blog somewhere, where your professional life is a marathon. You don't run the race and then suddenly you've got all the money to live for the rest of your life. Your professional life goes on year after year after year after year. And this is, Nicholas's run into the CCIE has been short but very, very concentrated. He's had a lot of time. You and I were talking a few days ago, Nicholas, and he had a lot of time to spend. Not only was he putting his personal time in it, but he also got professional time, whereas Tom did most of his study in his own personal time. So he ran the race in a longer run. And, that lack of focus meant it was harder for him to pass the first time around. But you've got to recognize that that's your life, that's your circumstances, and find a way that meets you, and then run that race. Run the race at your own pace. Don't measure yourself against... somebody who got through on the first time. I think my brother once said to me, he said, I said, how'd you go on your exam? And he said, 51%. I said, oh, you just got through. He said, mate, 51% is an effort, 50% is a pass.
This has been a good conversation. What do you say we wrap it up? Nicholas, thanks for joining us today. Can people follow you on Twitter? Do you have a blog, anything like that?
Yeah. I'm posting on blog.initialdraft.com, and you can find me on Twitter at MCL_Nicholas.
Excellent. And Tom, you're out in Las Vegas at Cisco Live. How much longer are you going to be there, and how can people find you on the internet?
I'm going to be out here until Friday morning when the plane takes off, but we'll be doing stuff here till Thursday. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Networking Nerd, or you can check out my blog at networkingnerd.net. But do be warned that I will be using a lot of hashtags at the event out here. And if any last night is any indication, there may be drinking involved.
So we'll consider all your tweets suspect until sometime next week when you've had time to detox.
Exactly.
And Kurt, it's bright and early in the morning over there on your side of the world. What you're working on, and how can people find you on the internet?
I can be found on Twitter as @networkjanitor, or my blog is network-janitor.net. This week I'm just finishing off a network audit I've been working on for a couple of weeks, and this afternoon I've got a HP Data Center Evolution seminar with some guys from Gartner and everything, so that should be thoroughly entertaining.
You said Gartner. I mean, that's, you had to fit it in, didn't you, before the end of the show? Make a Gartner reference.
Yeah. Gee, what?
Just so long as you're taking the tomatoes.
And Greg, of course, how can they find you, and what you're working on?
This week I'm building a data center for a very large organization, and we're in the very first week of engagement where we look at horror at the timeline, look with horror at the work that we have to do, and then get the knife out and start slicing the salami. Does that sound familiar to anybody who's studying for CCIE? It certainly should. You can find me at etherealmind.com, although I may be getting a little bit sparse in the weeks to come because I am insanely busy. You can find me on the Twitter as @etherealmind, and you can find me on Google Plus as Greg Farrow. I'd love to see you on the Google Plus because we all hate Facebook.
Yeah. And I am Ethan Banks. You can find me on Twitter at EC Banks. I am slowly but surely getting sucked into Google Plus, and I'm very happy with it. You can find me there as well. And my blog is packetattack.org, where I blog sporadically at best, and I have a lot of posts I've been meaning to write and never seeming to get to because I do things like I was doing just before this show, solving routing problems and configuring new hardware and so on, and everything's a hurry and got to be done right now. That's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'd appreciate your donations. We would appreciate your comments on the blog. Email us at packetpushers@gmail.com. Or visit us at packetpushers.net. Tell your friends, tell your vendors, and thanks for listening. Have a great week, everybody.